With the memory of that day still vivid in the front of her mind, Jessie once again began to apply downward pressure, trying to somehow shrink her hands enough so she could yank them through the cuffs. The pain struck sooner this time, starting not in her hands, but in the overtaxed muscles of her shoulders and arms. Jessie squeezed her eyes shut, bore down harder, and tried to shut out the hurt. Now her hands joined the chorus of outrage, and as she once more approached the outer limit of her muscular leverage, and the cuffs began to dig into the scant flesh which covered the backs of her hands, they began to scream. Posterior ligament, she thought. Head cocked, lips drawn back in a wide, spitless grin of pain. Posterior ligament. Posterior ligament, motherfucking posterior ligament. Nothing. No give. And she began to suspect, to strongly suspect, that there was more involved than ligaments. There were bones there as well. A couple of puky little bones running along the outsides of her hands below the lower thumb joint. A couple of puky little bones that were probably going to get her killed. With a final shriek of mingled pain and disappointment, Jessie let her hands go limp once more. Her shoulders and upper arms quivered with exhaustion. So much for sliding out of the cuffs, because they were M-17s instead of F-23s. The disappointment was almost worse than the physical pain. It stung like poisoned nettles. Shit and fuck! She cried at the empty room. Shit and fuck! Shit and fuck! Shit and fuck! Somewhere along the lake, farther off today by the sound, the chainsaw started up. And that made her even angrier. The guy from yesterday, back for more. Just some swinging dick in a red and black checked flannel shirt from L.L. Bean's, out there playing Paul Kiss My Ass Bunyan, roaring away with his McCulloch and dreaming about crawling into bed with his little honey at the end of the day. Or maybe it was football he was dreaming of, or just a few frosty cold ones down at the Marina Bar. Jessie saw the dork in the checked flannel shirt as clearly as she had seen the young girl in the stocks. And if thoughts alone could have killed him, his head would have exploded out through his asshole at that very moment.
It's not fair! She screamed. It's just not fair!
A kind of dry cramp seized her throat, and she fell silent, grimacing and afraid. She had felt the hard splinters of bone which barred her escape. Oh, God, had she! But she had been close just the same. That was the real wellspring of her bitterness, not the pain, and certainly not the unseen woodcutter with his blatting chainsaw. It was knowing that she had gotten close, but not quite close enough. She could continue to grit her teeth and endure the pain, but she no longer believed it would do her the slightest bit of good. That last quarter to half an inch was going to remain mockingly out of her reach. The only thing she could manage to do if she kept on pulling was to cause edema and swelling in her wrists, worsening her situation instead of bettering it. And don't you tell me I'm toast. Don't you dare, she said in a whispery, scolding voice. I don't want to hear that. You have to get out of them somehow, the young girl's voice whispered back. Because it really is going to come again. Tonight, after the sun goes down. I don't believe it, she croaked. I don't believe that man was real. I don't care about the footprint and the earring. I just don't believe it. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Jessie let her head droop to one side, hair hanging almost down to the mattress, mouth quivering abjectly. Yes, she did. She started to doze off again in spite of her worsening thirst and throbbing arms. She knew it was dangerous to sleep, that her strength would continue to ebb while she was out of it. But what difference did it really make? She had explored all her options and she was still America's handcuffed sweetheart. Besides, she wanted that lovely oblivion, craved it, in fact, the way a hophead craves his drug. Then, just before she drifted off, a thought which was both simple and shockingly direct lit up her confused, drifting mind like a flare. The face cream. The jar of face cream on the shelf above the bed. Don't get your hopes up, Jessie. That would be a bad mistake. If it didn't fall right off onto the floor when you tipped the shelf up, it probably slid to a place where you haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of getting hold of it. So don't get your hopes up. The thing was, she couldn't not get them up. Because if the face cream was still there, and still in a place where she could get hold of it, it might provide just enough slip to free one hand. Maybe both, although she didn't think that would be necessary. If she could pull out of one cuff, she would be able to get off the bed, and if she could get off the bed, she thought she would have it made. It was just one of those small plastic sample jars they send through the mail, Jessie. It must have slid off onto the floor. It hadn't, though. When Jessie had turned her head as far to the left as it would go without popping her neck out of joint, she was able to see a dark blue blob at the farthest edge of her vision. It's not really there. The hateful doom-mongering part of her whispered, "You think it's there. Perfectly understandable. But it's really not. It's just a hallucination, Jessie. Just you seeing what most of your mind wants you to see, orders you to see. Not me, though. I'm a realist." She looked again, straining a tiny bit farther to the left in spite of the pain. Instead of disappearing, the blue blob grew momentarily clearer. It was the sample jar, all right. There was a reading lamp on Jessie's side of the bed, and this hadn't slid off onto the floor when she tilted the shelf, because the base was fastened to the wood. A paperback copy of The Valley of Horses, which had been lying on the shelf since mid-July, had slid against the base of the lamp, and the jar of Nivea cream had slid against the book. Jessie realized it was possible that her life was going to be saved by a reading lamp and a bunch of fictional cave people with names like Ayla and Oda and Uba and Thonalan. It was more than amazing. It was surreal. "Even if it's there, you're never going to be able to reach it," the doom-monger told her. But Jessie barely heard it. The thing was, she thought she could reach the jar. She was almost sure of it. She turned her left hand within its restraint and reached slowly up to the shelf, moving with infinite care. It would not do to make a mistake now, to nudge the jar of Nivea cream out of reach along the shelf, or knock it backwards against the wall. For all she knew, there might now be a gap between the shelf and the wall, a gap a small sample-sized jar could easily drop through. And if that happened, she was quite sure her mind would break. Yes. She would hear the jar hit the floor down there, landing among the mouse turds and dust bunnies. And then her mind would just, well, break. So she had to be careful. And if she was, everything might yet be all right. Because maybe there is a God, she thought, and he doesn't want me to die here on this bed like an animal in a leg-hold trap. It makes sense when you stop to think about it. I picked that jar up off the shelf when the dog started chewing on Gerald, and then I saw it was too small and too light to do any damage, even if I managed to hit the dog with it. Under those circumstances, revolted, confused, and scared out of my mind, the most natural thing in the world would have been to drop it before feeling around on the shelf for something heavier. Instead of doing that, I put it back on the shelf. Why would I or anyone else do such an illogical thing? God, that's why. That's the only answer I can think of, the only one that fits. God saved it for me, because he knew I'd need it. She whispered her cuffed hand gently along the wood, trying to turn her splayed fingers into a radar dish. There must be no slip-ups. She understood that. Questions of God or fate or providence aside, this was almost certainly going to be both her best chance and her last one. And as her fingers touched the smooth, curved surface of the jar, a snatch of talking blues occurred to her. A little Dust Bowl ditty, probably composed by Woody Guthrie. She had first heard it sung by Tom Rush back in her college days. If you want to go to heaven, let me tell you how to do it. You gotta grease your feet with a little mutton suet. You just slide out of the devil's hand and ooze on over to the promised land. Take it easy. Go greasy. She slipped her fingers around the jar, ignoring the rusty pull of her shoulder muscles, moving with a slow, caressing care, and hooked the jar gently toward her. Now she knew how safecrackers felt when they were using nitro. Take it easy, she thought. Go greasy. Had truer words ever been spoken in the whole history of the world? I don't think so, my dear, she said in her snottiest Elizabeth Taylor, cat on a hot tin roof voice. She did not hear herself do this, did not even realize she had spoken. Already she could feel the blessed balm of relief stealing over her. It was as sweet as that first drink of fresh, cool water was going to be when she poured it over the rusty razor wire embedded in her throat. She was going to slide out of the devil's hand and ooze on over to the promised land. Absolutely no doubt about it. As long as she oozed carefully, that was. She had been tested. She had been tempered in the fire. Now she would reap her reward. She had been a fool to ever doubt. I think you better stop thinking that way, the goodwife said in a worried tone. It will make you careless. And I have an idea that very few careless people ever manage to slide out of the devil's hand. Probably true, but she hadn't the slightest intention of being careless. She had spent the last 21 hours in hell, and no one knew any better than she did how much was riding on this one. No one could know. Not ever. I'll be careful, Jessie crooned. I'll think out every step. I promise I will. And then She would what? Why, she would go greasy, of course. Not just until she got out of the handcuffs, but from now on. Jessie suddenly heard herself talking to God again, and this time she did it with an easy fluency. I want to make you a promise, she told God. I promise to go right on oozing. I'm going to start by having a big spring cleaning inside my head and throwing out all the broken stuff and the toys I outgrew a long time ago. All the stuff that isn't doing anything but taking up space and contributing to the fire hazard, in other words. I might call Nora Callaghan and ask her if she wants to help. I think I might call Carol Simons, too. Carol Rittenhouse these days, of course. If there's anyone in our old bunch who still knows where Ruth Neary is, it'll be Carol. Listen to me, Lord. I don't know if anyone ever gets to the promised land or not, but I promise to stay greasy and keep trying. Okay? And she saw, almost as though it were an approving answer to her prayer, exactly how it was supposed to go. Getting the top off the jar would be the toughest part. It would require patience and great care, but she would be helped by its unusually small size. Plant the jar's base on the palm of her left hand. Brace the top with her fingers. Use her thumb to do the actual unscrewing. It would help if the cap was loose, but she was pretty sure she would be able to get it off in any case. You're damn right I'll get it off, Toots, Jessie thought grimly. The most dangerous moment would probably come when the cap actually started to turn. If it happened all at once and she wasn't ready for it, the jar might shoot right out of her hand. Jessie voiced a croaky little laugh. Fat chance, she told the empty room. Fat fucking chance, my dear. Jessie held the jar up, looking at it fixedly. It was hard to see through the translucent blue plastic, but the container appeared to be at least half full, maybe a little more. Once the cap was off, she would simply turn the jar over in her hand and let the goo run out onto her palm. When she'd gotten as much as she could, she would tilt her hand up to the vertical, letting the cream run down to her wrist. Most of it would pool between her flesh and the cuff. She would spread it by rotating her hand back and forth. She already knew where the vital spot was anyway, the area just below the thumb. And when she was as greasy as she could get, she'd give one last pull, hard and steady. She would block out all pain and keep pulling until her hand slid through the cuff, and she was free at last. Free at last. Great God Almighty, free at last. She could do it. She knew she could. But carefully, she murmured, letting the base of the jar settle onto her palm and spacing the pads of her fingers and her thumb at intervals around the cap. And it's loose, she cried in a hoarse, trembling voice. Oh, my, and pumpkin pie, it really is. She could hardly believe it, and the doom-monger buried somewhere deep inside her refused to. But it was true. She could feel the cap rock a little on its spiral groove when she pressed the tips of her fingers gently up and down against it. Carefully, Jess. Oh, so carefully. Just the way you saw it. Yes. In her mind, she now saw something else. Saw herself sitting at her desk in Portland, wearing her best black dress, the fashionably short one she had bought herself last spring, as a present for sticking to her diet and losing 10 pounds. Her hair, freshly washed, and smelling of some sweet herbal shampoo instead of old sour sweat, was held in a simple gold clip. The top of the desk was flooded with friendly afternoon sunshine from the bow windows. She saw herself writing to the Nivea Corporation of America, or whoever it was that made Nivea face cream. Dear sirs, she would write, I just had to let you know what a lifesaver your product really is. When she applied pressure to the jar's cap with her thumb, it began to turn smoothly, without a single jerk. All according to plan. Like a dream, she thought. Thank you, God. Thank you. Thank you so very, very much. Sudden movement snagged the corner of her eye, and her first thought was not that someone had found her and she was saved, but that the space cowboy had come back to take her for itself before she could get away. Jessie voiced a shrill, startled cry. Her gaze leaped up from its intent focus point on the jar. Her fingers clutched it in an involuntary spasm of fright and surprise. It was the dog. The dog had returned for a late morning snack and was standing in the doorway, checking out the bedroom before coming in. At the same instant Jessie realized this, she also realized that she had squeezed the small blue jar much too hard. It was squirting through her fingers like a freshly peeled grape. No! She clutched for it and almost reinstated her grip. Then it tumbled out of her hand, struck her hip, and bounced off the bed. There was a mild and stupid clacking sound as the jar struck the wooden floor. This was the very sound which she had believed, less than 3 minutes ago, would drive her mad. It did not, and now she discovered a newer, deeper terror. In spite of everything which had happened to her, she was still a very long way from insanity. It seemed to her that, no matter what horrors might lie ahead for her now that this last door to escape had been barred, she must face them sane.
"Why do you have to come in now, you bastard?"
she asked the former prince, and something in her grating, deadly voice made it pause and look at her with a caution all her screams and threats had not been able to inspire.
"Why now, goddamn you? Why now?"
The stray decided the bitchmaster was probably still harmless, in spite of the sharp edges which now glinted in her voice. But it still kept a wary eye on her as it trotted over to its supply of meat. It was better to be safe. It had suffered greatly in the course of learning that simple lesson, and it wasn't one it would forget easily or soon. It was always better to be safe. It gave her one final look with its bright and desperate eyes before dipping its head, seizing one of Gerald's love handles, and tearing a large portion of it away. Seeing this was bad, but for Jessie it was not the worst. The worst was the cloud of flies which rose from their feeding and nesting ground when the stray locked its teeth and yanked. Their somnolent buzz finished the job of demolishing some vital, survival-oriented part of her, some part that had to do with both hope and heart. The dog stepped back as delicately as a dancer in a movie musical, its good ear cocked, the meat dangling from its jaws. Then it turned and trotted quickly from the room. The flies were beginning resettlement operations even before it was out of sight. Jessie leaned her head back against the mahogany crossboards and closed her eyes. She began praying again, but this time it was not escape she prayed for. This time she prayed that God would take her quickly and mercifully, before the sun went down, and the white-faced stranger came back. The next 4 hours were the worst of Jessie Burlingame's life. The cramps in her muscles grew steadily more frequent and more intense, but it wasn't intramuscular pain that made the hours between 11 and 3 so terrible. It was her mind's stubborn, gruesome refusal to relinquish its hold on lucidity and go into the dark. She had read Poe's The Telltale Heart in junior high school, but not until now had she grasped the real horror of its opening lines.
"Nervous. True, very nervous I am and have been. But why will you say I am mad?"
Madness would be a relief, but madness would not come. Neither would sleep. Death might beat them both, and dark certainly would. She could only lie on the bed, existing in a dull, olive-drab reality, shot through with occasional gaudy blasts of pain, as her muscles cramped up. The cramps mattered, and so did her horrible, tiresome sanity, but little else seemed to. Certainly the world outside this room had ceased to hold any real meaning for her. In fact, she came to strongly believe that there was no world outside this room, that all the people who had once filled it had gone back to some existential central casting office, and all the scenery had been packed away like stage flats after a college drama society production. Time was a cold sea through which her consciousness forged like a waddling, graceless icebreaker. Voices came and went like phantoms. Most spoke inside her head, but for a while Nora Callaghan talked to her from the bathroom, and at another point Jessie had a conversation with her mother, who seemed to be lurking in the hall. Her mother had come to tell her that Jessie would never have gotten into a mess like this if she had been better about picking up her clothes. "If I had a nickel for every slip I fished out of the corner and turned right side out," her mother said, "I could buy the Cleveland Gas Works." This had been a favorite saying of her mother's, and Jessie realized now that none of them had ever asked her why she would want the Cleveland Gas Works. She continued to exercise weekly, pedaling with her feet and pumping her arms up and down as far as the handcuffs and her own flagging strength would allow. She no longer did this to keep her body ready for escape when the right option finally occurred to her, because she had finally come to understand, in her heart and in her head, that there were no options left. The jar of face cream had been the last. She was exercising now only because the movement seemed to alleviate the cramps a little. In spite of the exercise, she could feel coldness creeping into her feet and hands, settling onto her skin like a skim of ice and then working its way in. This was nothing like the gone-to-sleep feeling with which she had awakened this morning. It was more like the frostbite she had suffered during a long afternoon of cross-country skiing as a teenager. Sinister gray spots on the back of one hand and on the flesh of her calf where her legging hadn't quite covered. Dead spots that seemed impervious to even the baking heat of the fireplace. She supposed this numbness would finally overwhelm the cramps, and that in the end her death might turn out to be quite merciful after all, like going to sleep in a snowbank. But it was moving much too slowly. Time passed, but it wasn't time. It was just a relentless, unchanging flow of information passing from her sleepless senses to her eerily lucid mind. There was only the bedroom, the scenery outside, the last few stage flats yet to be packed away by the prop master in charge of this shitty little production, the buzz of flies turning Gerald into a late-season incubator, and the slow movement of shadows along the floor as the sun made its way across a painted autumn sky. Every now and then a cramp would stab into one of her armpits like an ice pick or pound a thick steel nail into her right side. As the afternoon wore endlessly long, the first cramps began to strike into her belly, where all hunger pangs had now ceased, and into the overstressed tendons of her diaphragm. These latter were the worst, freezing the sheath of muscles in her chest and locking down her lungs. She stared up at the reflected water ripples on the ceiling with agonized, bulging eyes as each one struck, arms and legs trembling with effort, as she tried to continue breathing until the cramp eased. It was like being buried up to the neck in cold, wet cement. Hunger passed, but thirst did not, and as that endless day turned about her, she came to realize that simple thirst, only that and nothing more, might accomplish what the increasing levels of pain and even the fact of her own oncoming death hadn't been able to. It might drive her mad. It wasn't just her throat and mouth now. Every part of her body cried out for water. Even her eyeballs were thirsty, and the sight of the ripples dancing on the ceiling to the left of the skylight made her groan softly. With these very real perils closing in on her, the terror she had felt of the space cowboy should have waned or disappeared entirely. But as the afternoon drew on, she found the white-faced stranger weighing more heavily on her mind rather than less. She saw its shape constantly, standing just beyond the small circle of light which enclosed her reduced consciousness, and although she could make out little more than its general shape, thin to the point of emaciation, she found she could see the sunken, sickly grin that curved its mouth with greater and greater clarity as the sun dragged its harrow of hours into the west. In her ear she heard the dusty murmur of the bones and jewels as its hand stirred them in its strange, old-fashioned case. It would come for her. When it was dark, it would come. The dead cowboy, the outsider, the specter of love. You did see it, Jesse. It was death, and you did see it. As people who die in the lonely places often do. Of course they do. It's stamped on their twisted faces, and you can read it in their bulging eyes. It was old cowboy death. And tonight, when the sun goes down, he'll be back for you. Shortly after 3, the wind, which had been calm all day, began to pick up. The back door began to bang restlessly against the jamb again. Not long after, the chainsaw quit, and she could hear the faint sound of wind-driven wavelets slapping against the rocks along the shore. The loon did not raise its voice. Perhaps it had decided the time had come to fly south, or at least relocate to a part of the lake where the screaming lady could not be heard. It's just me now. Until the other one gets here, at least. She no longer made any effort to believe her dark visitor was only imagination. Things had gone much too far for that. A fresh cramp sank long, bitter teeth into her left armpit, and she pulled her cracked lips back in a grimace. It was like having your heart poked with the tines of a barbecue fork. Then the muscles just below her breasts tightened, and the bundle of nerves in her solar plexus seemed to ignite like a pile of dry sticks. This pain was new, and it was enormous, far beyond anything she had experienced thus far. It bent her backward like a greenwood stick, torso twisting from side to side, knees snapping open and shut. Her hair flew in clots and clumps. She tried to scream and couldn't. For a moment she was sure this was it, the end of the line. One final convulsion, as powerful as six sticks of dynamite planted on a granite ledge, and out you go, Jesse, cashiers on your right. But this one passed too. She relaxed, slowly, panting. Her head turned up toward the ceiling. For the moment, at least, the dancing reflections up there didn't torment her. All her concentration was focused on that fiery bundle of nerves between and just below her breasts, waiting to see if the pain was really going to go away or if it would flare up again instead. It went, but grudgingly, with a promise to be back soon. Jessie closed her eyes, praying for sleep. Even a short release from the long and tiresome job of dying would be welcome at this point.